Welcome to Engineering Influence, a podcast from the American Council of Engineering Companies, broadcasting live from Chicago at our 2019 fall conference, joined by Jim Smith, the ACEC North Carolina executive, and getting a state update on what's going on.
Morning. Good morning, Jeff.
How are you?
I'm great.
So far, so good. Good conference?
Very good.
Good. Now, I know you guys have two big issues.
We do.
Yeah, indemnification and duty to defend.
Correct.
And then really an issue with DOT and the state. So
good to bad.
Good to bad. So let's start with the good.
Okay.
Let's talk about the victory that you just had regarding indemnification and duty to defend. If you can kind of give our listeners a little bit of an update on the challenge they faced and how you kind of surmounted it.
Be glad to. One of the big issues that most engineering firms face is that many owners impose very onerous third-party and broad-form indemnification clauses in their contracts, and also duty-to-defend clauses. And that requires a firm, if they sign the contract, to perform those requirements, defend the owner, you know, indemnify him, even if they have no fault in what occurred.
Yeah.
Now, this has been going on for decades, and it's across the board, across the country. There have been some states that have recently had success. Probably most recently was Georgia a couple years ago. So actually, our XCOM member, Stephanie Hashem, who was involved in the Georgia experience a couple years ago, actually emailed me about a year and a half ago and said, you know, we should try to get this accomplished. And the board agreed in North Carolina, so we moved on to the process of running the bill, and we're successful in passing it.
That's fantastic. So that's a great example for other states to follow.
That's, yes.
It's something you need to step up and fight.
I've actually heard from probably at least 10 states that are thinking of running their own bills.
Yeah.
The interesting part about what happened with us was we were successful in not only getting those clauses ruled against public policy. They're no longer enforceable. But we also got that to reflect on both public and private contracts.
Okay.
Which Indiana was able to do as well earlier this year.
So how was that process advocating for that change? How, I mean, because something like this has been kind of baked into the cake for so long, what kind of education effort had to be undertaken to really nail the point home about how onerous this is for engineering firms?
Well, I think one of the keys to this was we followed a step-by-step process, and we were very careful. Number one, we organized a task force, and it was composed of a coalition of organizations. Since we had an existing bill that provided some protection but not much, and it was focused on the construction industry more than the design professional community, we pulled together the four entities that were included in that original bill. Design professionals, both engineering and architecture, landscape architects, and also surveyors. So that was our coalition up front. The two predominant agencies were probably the architects and the engineers, since we have more of those contracts.
Yeah.
So we organized a task force that was composed of myself, my counterpart at AIA, our respective councils, who were very familiar with the situation. Stephanie, of course, chaired the task force. And I think one of the keys was keeping that group small and focused. Number two, we developed a strategy. We did our due diligence early on, identifying who our opponents might be and also who might be our advocates.
Mm-hmm.
Three, we had a consistent, controlled message, which I think is really important.
It's critical.
The bigger the group gets, the more chances are that people are going to go off script.
Absolutely.
And then finally, we decided at the time, I've been the lobbyist for ACEC North Carolina up until this point. And luckily, the board agreed that, you know, we're going to need help on this. You're going to need help. And when you run a bill, you've almost got to be down at the legislature full time.
Yeah, essentially.
So we hired a contract lobbyist who was an affiliate member of ours.
Okay.
Did a fantastic job. And then once we did our due diligence, contacted, you know, entities pro and con, we started looking for not only draft language for the bill, but for bill sponsors. And we were lucky in the fact that we have an engineer in the State House who is a great advocate for us, and also another, although not an engineer, had come from the utility industry in the Senate. And I can't emphasize enough how key it was to have passionate, committed sponsors.
That's a really important point to make, because from my experience, my background in advocacy, if you can engage stakeholders, if you can identify your allies and your opponents, just like you did, you can identify champions in your target houses, chambers,
right,
and they can carry your message, it makes things significantly easier, and it just amplifies your effort, because you have someone who already has their own internal stakeholder group within their own party membership or their committees or what have you. Be able to multiply that message is just, you can't beat that.
Very true. And I think besides that, what we decided to do was we ran companion bills in the House and the Senate in order to get to crossover before the deadline. And I'm sure most listeners probably are familiar with crossover dates. You've got to get through one house before it can move to the other house by a certain deadline in our session. So we made that through the House. The decision then was made to run the House bill in the Senate by our Senate sponsor. Now, one of the major strategies we decided, and this came from our sponsors, these clauses, although they're onerous for any firm, they're especially onerous for small, medium-sized firms, firms with very few resources to combat anything like this. So we focused on the situation for minority, women-owned, small business. And it's interesting, at first we weren't quite sure that would work, but our sponsors were dedicated to that, yeah. And in the end it turned out to be very helpful.
And that's another good point, because you could have a primary issue that you're fighting, and you know that taking the straight line approach to talk about the issue may be the easiest path. But sometimes it really pays dividends to look at all the different angles that you can possibly take. Just like in your instance, when you look at the fact that the size of the firms that are largely affected, what are some of the unique factors that go into those firms? And you do hit the minority-owned, women-owned, you get into just the small business side of things, and you're able to create messages and target potential allies that you otherwise might not have if you didn't take that time to actually do that due diligence at the front end.
That was an interesting part, because I think I can't emphasize either how important it is to do the due diligence up front. There's no point in introducing a bill to find out who your opposition is. So we contacted anyone that we thought might be opposed to changing these requirements. The bigger cities such as Charlotte or Raleigh, county government, local government, who used a lot of these clauses. The bill that was prior to this, the previous bill, also included some exemptions for certain parts of the industry. It exempted the Department of Transportation, it exempted utilities, and railroads. Well, our Senate sponsor came from the utility industry and up front immediately said, well, we don't even enforce these clauses against contractors or anybody, because we know they can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one good aspect. So we contacted those exempted entities and all those, and basically we didn't receive much pushback on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we did end up with one group that opposed us.
And who was that?
That was the Associated General Contractors. We approached them early on, believing that with them as part of the original decades-old bill, they would want to have these protections as well. Now, one aspect of indemnification and duty to defend, broad form, is that it's uninsurable under a professional designer's professional liability coverage, which is that was one argument. Although we tended to downplay that, contractors who can be sued in the same aspects can get that coverage under their commercial and general liability. So we approached them early on. They really didn't respond much at the time, and we finally decided that we were ready to go with running the bill. The night before our draft bill was to be heard in the first House committee, they announced they were going to come out in opposition to it.
Okay. Yeah. The 11th hour.
Which is good at the 11th hour.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that this is a good example for anyone out there, or any of our member organizations who are interested in taking on the same kind of approach, to really reach out to both ACEC National, Steve Hall, our advocacy team, and also to Jim in North Carolina for kind of a playbook or a best practice case on how to undertake this kind of a campaign, because it can happen. You can get it done. It's just a question of doing it in a certain way.
Yes.
And one of the benefits of ACEC membership is that you have that information sharing. So really encourage people to take advantage of that. And if you're going to undertake your own advocacy effort on this issue, reach out, because we can help set you up for success early on.
There are a lot of resources out there to help, and ACEC National is one of the biggest ones with all the information they've gathered over the years from different states.
Yeah.
So that was extremely helpful.
So that was the good news. And you can't have good without some bad.
Right.
And
I do want to add, with AGC,
uh-huh.
they did publicly oppose us.
Yeah.
Now, our bill sponsors indicated, and this is always a strategy they like to do, no one likes to introduce a bill that has opposition.
Yeah, of course not.
So we agreed, we worked with AGC, met with them, tried to come up with a compromise. Their position was rather weak in that it finally came out that they like to use these clauses in contracts of their own against their own subcontractors. And they tried to make the argument that, well, if there is a third-party claim like this, they want everybody at the table. And we're trying to say that if this bill passed, we would not be at the table. Well, the thing we constantly emphasized was, this is third-party indemnification and duty to defend when the design professional has no responsibility for the claim.
Yeah.
And this in no way changed the design professional having responsibility if he is at fault.
Mm-hmm.
So that wouldn't have changed, or would be ruled as partially at fault in a court case. If that happened, we'd be right at the table, taking on our responsibility.
Yeah. That's a good point. So what else is happening? Because you mentioned DOT North Carolina.
The good and the bad.
The good and the bad. So let's get into the bad. What are you facing right now with those guys?
Well, soon after we got the bill passed, at the same time this was happening, our industry was in a very accelerated delivery program with the DOT. This started about 2.5 years ago, and the legislature had mandated that the DOT accelerate the program. They had built up a cash balance of over $2 billion. The legislature was unhappy with delivery, how slow it was going. So when the new administration came in order to get approval for his position as Secretary of State, or Secretary of Transportation, he agreed that they would accelerate the program. Now, for our industry, that's a great thing.
Yeah.
Lots more projects, lots of money going out. So the industry ramped up, got the work done. Now, with any kind of program that's paying down a balance,
yeah,
there's going to be an end to that eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And it was projected at 2 to 3 years. Well, there were a couple of mitigating circumstances that occurred during that time. Number one, North Carolina experienced a number of severe hurricanes.
Yes.
Lots of damage, lots of storm recovery. And the DOT pays for that from their maintenance budget. It's not additional.
It's not emergency spending. It's not disaster spending. It's just maintenance.
You're right. So up until 2016, the average for 12 to 15 years had been about $60 million a year. Once Michael hit Hurricane Michael in 2016, and then succeeding storms like Florence and others, they averaged from 2016 to 2019 over $200 million a year,
yeah,
which was severe.
Yeah.
Now, some of that will be reimbursed by FEMA,
mm-hmm,
but FEMA reimbursements are extremely slow.
Extremely slow.
I think at this point in time, they might have received half of their dedicated reimbursement, mm-hmm, for Michael alone in 2016,
yeah,
and nothing yet for the storm since. So that compounded the pay down of cash on projects. The second issue was, about 20 years ago, the legislature passed what they titled the MAP Act. That allowed the DOT to acquire property for future corridors, not necessarily prior to a project by eminent domain or anything, but for projects down the road in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So they began a process of doing that, and over the years, of course, acquired a lot of property and paid property owners. That was declared unconstitutional about 18 months ago. So the DOT had to embark on a program of paying back
all that money,
that money with interest, with court fees.
Uh-huh.
So
further draining the budget.
Exactly. So that started ramping up and being included in the cash pay down. And I think up to this summer, they had probably exceeded $300 million with a projected total by the end of over $1 billion.
Wow.
So we saw this coming. We have a strong partnering relationship with the DOT. But the DOT kept insisting they did not want to slow down the pre-construction engineering program, because they wanted projects on the shelves to keep moving. They pushed out construction contracts, you know, suspended some of those, even though they still had a pretty healthy program going on. They also cut maintenance budgets here and there. You know, they always use the example of, well, we didn't do as much highway mowing, things of that nature. So even though, you know, a prudent business person would look at this and say, you know, this is just not sustainable at the rate it's going, up through the summer and even into July, the message was, don't worry about it. We're doing all kinds of other things. We have no intention of touching pre-construction or preliminary engineering. That all changed in late July. At that point, the crisis got so bad for them that the cash balance was approaching the minimum mandated by the legislature.
And how much do they have to have as a minimum in the bank?
Well, it's pegged at 7.5% of the current budget. Mm-hmm. And that would be anywhere from $250 to $300 million.
Okay.
So they were approaching that, getting awful close. So what they did initially was they mandated the reduction in the construction engineering and inspection program of 20%.
Okay.
Now, a good many of our firms do a lot of C&EI work. Mm-hmm. So that was an immediate release. And by immediate, I mean on a Friday afternoon, a lot of field people were told, you're done, you're going home. So that occurred at the end of July. And I would say at this point, probably over 400 people in our industry have been laid off.
Really?
Because it's hard to absorb them in other types of work.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that kind of set off the alarm bells. We started looking at the situation and realized we had to advocate for cash.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, the DOT was projecting, although this was not a revenue crisis, it was a cash crisis.
Yeah.
How do we get FEMA reimbursement speeded up? Would the legislature be willing to reimburse the DOT for MAP Act settlements? So we ramped up our advocacy program, realizing that we had to do something. And so we decided we're going to look at trying to convince the legislature to infuse cash.
Yeah.
Well, it got worse. As of the end, on August 30th, the DOT issued a memo to all their divisions that basically suspended 900 planning and design projects, which, in the case of some firms, was the bulk of their workload.
Yeah, exactly.
So now we had a real crisis on our hands. Mm-hmm. So at that point, we realized we needed a far bigger voice. And we often advocate with contractors and material suppliers and all. They, of course, weren't seeing this immediately, but they would see it down the road.
Mm-hmm. You know, when they knew it was coming down the pike. I mean, it's only so long until they start getting hit.
Right. So one of the suggestions by one of our major firms who had a person on the state chamber board, and years ago the state chamber had advocated for funding. They had a program back then called Can't Afford to Wait. So we resurrected that. The chamber agreed to resurrect that initiative and agreed to lead a broad-based coalition of industry firms that were interested in this. And it became the Can't Afford to Stop campaign.
Yeah.
So we've been working diligently there at the legislature. We've got friends at the legislature who are willing to work at a solution.
Okay.
And, of course, we mobilized our folks. And it really worked. I mean, they came up to the plate, contacted their own legislators. The best story they could tell was what was the effect of this on their firms.
Yeah.
And the biggest issue was job loss. I would say as of right now, design firms are starting to feel the heat. So probably we're in the range of anywhere from 500 to 600 or more that have been laid off in our industry.
Yeah.
And that message doesn't play very well when you've got a booming economy.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. You know, everybody's talking about how, you know, the economy is growing and, you know, there are no jobs to be found because everybody's in full employment. And then all of a sudden you see the sector of the industry getting, you know, 400, 500 people laid off. And that doesn't play well. Doesn't play well in a political season either.
No. You compound that with the fact that we're in a state where the budget was vetoed by the governor.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that it didn't include Medicaid expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So we not only had to convince the legislature to do something, and we're at that point now, even though there's some skepticism as to the DOT's cash management policies.
Yeah.
But we've also had to contact the governor's office to make sure if we got something passed, would he sign it? So as of right now, they're on recess for a week.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming back into session next week. We've got the potential for a draft bill by the end of this week. that would infuse cash.
All right.
And hopefully that would get most of that earmarked to our projects to restart.
Got it.
Get our folks back to work.
All right. So right now, hopefully there'll be news when they come back into session.
Exactly.
So, but the sounds like you've laid the groundwork.
So. They promised to adjourn finally by October 31st, so we've got 2 weeks to get that done.
Got it. Well, I mean, you've already proven that you can advocate and get something done. So fingers crossed that this carries through to the cash crisis as well.
Yes.
But it shows that, you know, the work is never done. There's always something else. And something else will always pop up that you're going to have to knock down, right? And it's usually the most unexpected things. But it's you know, we wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you.
And, of course, you know, ACEC Nationals here to help however we can. Sure. Great. Well, Jim, I really appreciate the update. Good luck on that second, and congratulations on the first on indemnification and duty to defend. That's a great success for the industry, and keep us informed. Let us know how it turns out.
Will do.
Thanks.
You bet. Thank you.